Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Isabel Schuler about her historical novel, Lady Macbethad. Isabel is a Swiss-Hawaiian-American actress, writer and former bookseller. She has a BA in journalism, and her screenplay, Queen Hereafter, was longlisted by the 1000 Films Screenwriting Competition in 2019. In 2020, she adapted Queen Hereafter into her debut novel, Lady Macbethad. In this episode, we discuss the themes of gender and ambition that inspired her novel, how she turned a 60-minute pilot episode script and TV Bible into a book, and what it's like to be confronted by bad reviews. But first, here's Isabel with an excerpt from Lady Macbethad.
In the end, it did not take 2 days for Finlich and my father to reach their decision. On the evening of Crinan's arrival, it was announced that Finlich had released me and I was to be betrothed. There goes the next Queen of Alba. I read the thought in their eyes and tried to return it with one of my own. I will be a great one. I will make you proud to say you live in the Kingdom of Alba. Macbeth had remained unmoved by the change in my status. He did not speak to me and had only one-word answers for Duncan, whom he avoided as much as possible. I matched his indifference with a callousness of my own. Who was he to resent my destiny? Donalda's sadness over our growing animosity elicited the only remorse I felt. She had wanted more for our relationship, and while I knew this was the only way forward, I felt sorry that I could not fulfill her desire after all she had done for me. She was particularly attentive in the last days, fretting over me as any good mother would. She chose which clothes I would take with me to Dunkeld. She bought me delicate trinkets attached to thin pieces of leather to hang around my neck, and little pins from the craftsmen in Burghead to ornament my cloak. I would miss her deeply. Lying in bed the night before my departure, I found myself unable to sleep. I tried out Queen Gruach, speaking it quietly under my breath to see how the word sounded. They both thrilled and terrified me. It did not seem quite real. I wished my grandmother could see me now, her prophecy unfolding. Though I was certain this union with Duncan was my destiny, I tried out a different name, more foreign but more fitting. I repeated it softly to myself, speaking it into the night, feeling the shape of it in my mouth and the taste of it on my tongue. Lady Macbethad.
Hi Isabel, welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on me today to discuss your debut novel, Lady Macbethad.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here.
So can you start by telling us what Lady Macbethad is about?
Yes, Lady Macbethad is a book about power and passion and drive and ambition, and it centers on the life of Gruach Ingenbode, the real Lady Macbeth. And it is set against the backdrop of medieval Scotland and kind of takes place all over the place. So it's this real sweeping historical fiction.
I was so amazed when I started this book because I literally had no idea of the origins of Macbeth. I studied it at school, and yet I don't remember ever being taught that there was like a real basis of the story. And I'm reading it at first thinking, Isabel's this incredible, I mean, you do anyway, an incredible imagination, but so I'm thinking to make up these characters, think about it and think there's something real about this. So tell us where you heard about this story, because I know that you grew up near the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. So you've always had kind of Shakespeare around you and in your life from a young age. What was it about this story that kind of grabbed you out of all the other Shakespeare stories?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd seen the play at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I saw most of Shakespeare's plays, which was definitely a gift. But it wasn't until, because I have a background in acting as well. I sort of started professionally acting when I was about 13. And it was in an acting class and an acting situation in which I first came across the text of Macbeth in any kind of real way. Just in playing her, and then I also had the chance to play her when I was in my early 20s in a short film, and so those few experiences that I had kind of more intimately with the character, I was able to pick up on some of the things in the text that I just found really problematic. There's a lot of the kind of the most prominent one being that there is a lot of gendered language around ambition in the play, especially kind of the first time we meet Lady Macbeth, Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth. She's found out that her husband has received this incredible prophecy that he's going to be king, and her first, I love it, her first thought is he's not going to be able to pull this off, which is really amusing. But then her kind of follow-up thing is that she prays to the gods to unsex her and to kind of take away, she says, drain me of human kindness, and fill me top to toe with direst cruelty. And not that I'm advocating for that, but there's this sense of kind of needing to strip yourself of everything that makes you a woman, or certainly the society's expectations of womanhood, which there's something in that, but for her particularly, kind of the fact that her womanness would get in the way of her sort of single-minded ambition. And as an actor, I think you have a unique job with a lot of Shakespeare's female characters to bring to life someone with integrity, and to make sure that if you don't believe in the character, or if you are judging the character, then that's really going to hamper your ability to be able to play her empathetically and authentically. And so suddenly all of these problems become a lot more real, because you kind of think, okay, how do I get over this, and how do I imagine this character in such a way that allows both for what I understand women to be and what she would have understood that. And so, so you do the job, and I did. But as the character, she never really left me. And for people who know the play well, there's a lot of kind of lore around it. It's quite a superstitious play. There's got the witches in it. And so I kind of like to think that the spirit of Lady Macbeth never truly left, because she knew she wanted her story to be told. So yeah, that was kind of how I first came to the story, and also why her story in particular really grabbed me at that time, and kind of stayed with me until I wrote this.
Yeah, I can absolutely see why. And then that inspired you to write this TV pilot,
Oh,
which
yes.
the initial kind of, I guess, the Bible before you'd written the novel. At what point did you decide, actually, I'm going to transform it into a novel? And what was the process like for doing that? Because I imagine it's very different from being a kind of a script and a concept to then becoming this huge novel.
Yeah, it really is. And actually, I'm really glad I get to talk about this, because I think, first of all, when I say I wrote the TV show, I did. I wrote a 60-minute pilot, like a first episode, and then I wrote a TV Bible, which is just this massive document that kind of is almost like the blueprint for the TV show. So it gives you all the characters, it gives you character arcs, gives you the themes of the show, and then it gives like an episode breakdown for each of the episodes. It kind of says here's the script, but here's what happens in episode two, here's what happens in episode three, four, five, six. So in a way, I had mapped out the whole story. However, I think, as is to be expected, the TV pilot is very, very different from the book, not just it like in plot, but also in theme. I didn't have, there's so much in the book that I didn't have in the TV show, because I was writing specifically for TV, so I also kind of had almost like a producer's cap on. So we actually never see Gruach as a child at all. We meet her sort of at the end of her time at Dunkeld when she's 17, and we follow her for maybe 4 or 5 years, which is only the second half of the book. So the whole first half of the book I hadn't even thought of until I had to sit down and write it. And actually, in terms of why I decided to novelize it, it's a really sort of a boring practical reason, which was that we were pitching the script around, and everybody really loved the story and was really encouraging, but also said, you are a first-time screenwriter, and this is a huge budget historical, period drama. Like, your best case scenario is to sell the idea to someone. You might not even get like a creator credit, and you'd have no control. You know, it would you would just sell you would sell the idea. You'd have no ownership of the intellectual property, and actually, you would be far better off writing this as a book. And it's funny because that story in particular kind of lives in my head as something specific because and I don't I'd have to check with my agent now, but I'm happy to sort of add to the lore around this story, but which is that one of the companies that we pitched it to was Natalie Dormer's production company.
Oh, wow.
And I think the producer, I'm pretty sure, I do remember this. I remember this conversation. It was a very busy time in my life, but they had really liked it. And the way that I think I had interpreted what my agent was saying is that Natalie Dormer loved it, but she thought it should be a book. So I was like, oh, well, if Natalie Dormer tells me to do this, I'm 100% going to do this. I think it was possibly more a general trend of what producers were saying, but in my mind, Natalie Dormer told me to write a book, so I
Amazing.
did.
That should be
Yeah.
the title page of the
Yeah. Inspired by Lady Macbeth and Natalie Dormer. No. Yeah. So then, actually getting down to it and writing it as a book was a real shift. I think one of the things when I was writing the screenplay, because I wrote the screenplay in I think yeah late 2018, early 2019, and then I didn't sort of sit down to write the book until October of 2020. And I had done a big wave of research in the first instance when I was writing the TV show. But there were all sorts of things that I was like, oh, the production designer can figure that out, or oh, the costume designer can figure that out. And I remember sitting down to write the first chapter, and I wrote like she walked across the, and then I was like, wait, I don't like, is this dirt? Is this wood? Is this stone? Like, I have no idea what the material world of this woman looks like. And so then I did another, like I had to do kind of a second wave of research, which I thought was kind of a one-off, and I can talk about this later, but actually it's worked out that way with my second book as well, where I did a big bout of research and then did a first draft, and now I'm, you know, have done a second bout of research. But that was kind of for Lady Macbeth, that was when I really filled out the world of the story. So what they, you know, what they would have been eating and where they would have been going, and kind of invariably in doing that, I also just dug deeper into the history because, you know, with books that you don't get in film so much is you can just expand the world so much more. And I think I remember the real moment when for me it finally switched in my head from a script to a book, and kind of I saw the excitement and the potential for that is I had the idea for the prophecy. So the prophecy is not in the pilot. But Lady Macbeth, when she's about 5 years old, receives this prophecy that she interprets. I didn't actually say this, but she interprets it to be that she will one day be queen. And it very much mirrors the prophecy that Macbeth gets in the play. And once I kind of had that in place and had the character of her grandmother, and you know, with meeting her at 5 years old, it's then that the kind of I got really excited about the novel and kind of the scope that you could have with this woman, and actually the fact that you could do her more justice in a novel than you could in a TV show.
I love this idea of you getting this second flash almost of inspiration that helped develop the idea of a more. I kind of think of it like when you're doing multiple drafts of a novel, and then suddenly on draft four, you come up with an idea that then reshapes. I'm sure there are people listening that can relate to this, that you're kind of wading through, and then suddenly something occurs to you, and you think, why hadn't I thought of this, ago when I was first drafting it? But I love that idea. But also, I imagine that writing the novel as opposed to the script, you really had to inhabit the character a lot more. So, can you tell us about Grok for us? Did you how you kind of went from the research and the Bible that you created to then fleshing her out into this fully rounded character for the novel?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I came to it. Yeah, I had all the research. I had my own personal background, and then I have the character that we have in the play, and the things that I really love about her ambition, her single-mindedness, and some of the things that really don't mesh in her character. I think there's this real transition that happens, in the middle of the play, where she goes from this very controlled, kind of with it woman, and then, from one scene to the next, she just completely falls apart, and it makes absolutely no sense. So there were these things that I wanted to bring to the character, just from a personal from a personal perspective. And one of them, one of the facets of her character, I mean, I could tell you about how she's, ambitious and simple-minded and driven and passionate and, and has this kind of unbridled desire. But for me, a really important facet of her character is she's quite emotional. She's really emotional, and she never, I find often the trajectory of a lot of women in historical fiction, which is absolutely fine because it's writer's choice. But they go from this kind of naive, if especially when you track someone like this, like over an entire lifetime, they go from this kind of naive child, and then they learn the world and they understand it, and then they grow into this woman who's able to just perfectly control herself. And you have these images of like these, I don't know, these like Tudor women kept completely tucked tight, and then maybe they're in their bedroom and they like scream, and then and they let out their rage, and then like they button it all together and they go back about their lives. And Gruick is just one of these characters who never learns how to do that. She never kind of learns to, in kind of modern parlance, emotionally regulate. And I think there is this thing of the kind of the emotional woman, and this idea that we feel very uncomfortable with in society of either a woman who expresses her grief a bit too loudly or too openly, or too big emotion, or similarly anger. I think we really, really struggle as a society with the idea of the angry woman, especially if that anger is not manifested as a like calm, controlled anger, but is instead kind of like a ragey thing. And that is, in terms of one of the many things about her character that I think makes her, that ties in the research, the time, the my personal experience, the play, is just this woman who does have all of these desires and is constantly thwarted, and is constantly, things constantly are getting in her way. And even though she keeps bulldozing through them all, she has no filter. And I think that was really fun to play with, especially when she kind of comes into relationship with a character named Ardith, who is that idea of, she's a very manipulative woman. She's very, which is great. And she is very controlled, and she's kind of that, more of that archetypal, like, scheming, plotting woman. And Gruick is just always telling everybody what she's going to do, which is not the, which is, you know, which no, it's not wise, and it does make her petty, and it does make her all of these things. But I just think that that is, for me, I love that, and I think that version of her actually gels more with Shakespeare's character, because that kind of woman is a woman who then is, is kind of loses it and falls apart because she's already in this kind of heightened emotional state. So anyway, that is a lot of words, but it's been something that, kind of, this interview is falling at a unique time. I've had some distance now from publication. It's, just been just over a month. I've not done an interview in a while, so I've had a chance to really like think about who she is and percolate and all the answers. Not that I was giving wrong answers before, but like the thing that just is standing out to me with some time and with some distance is this side of her that probably I most identify with, which is just that I'm massively emotional.
And I read that you said that your kind of career as an actor has really helped you in terms of writing and in embodying characters. And I'm guessing from your kind of passion for Lady Macbeth that that has really come out, and you really feel that about her. Do you think that has helped you create her as more than just kind of a woman that you found on the page in your research?
Yeah, definitely. For me personally, I mean, every writer will have their own process, but I think, a kind of decades, over a decade of inhabiting other people, in a way, and bringing them to life has it definitely influences my writing. I think, especially I found both I think in a good way, and then there are also pitfalls of that. So I've found recently in my second draft I have a lot of physical facial expressions, and like a lot of kind of showing what's going on in the inside by like, the way that they're standing, or that, like there's a real physicality in it, which is fine, but I think kind of learning that actually maybe that doesn't serve me so well, so they're kind of, they're both good sides and bad sides to it. But I do say kind of the line that I often use is that I think most actors would make excellent writers, because I think you can teach the craft of writing. You can teach how to craft a sentence and how to, and you can read, and I do think you can learn to do that. But what the sort of unique, I think the unique take that actors have is that it is our business to constantly be thinking about people's objectives and motives. What do they want? How are they getting it? What is standing in their way? What are they going to do when they hit that obstacle? How are they going to get around it? And so that I think that character approach is just so, as a writer, that's all I do all day long, is just think about what does she want in the scene? Why isn't she getting it? Who's standing in her way? What's standing in her way? What is she going to do? And that's where that, that's obviously these are kind of the building blocks of creating drama.
I often think that kind of character motivation and when you're thinking about your characters in that way, and that every scene should serve that motivation in some ways, is one of the hardest aspects of writing. And I think that often as writers, we write to find out those questions. So I imagine that having that kind of acting background really helps you explore the different options of what your character might be wanting and how they're going to go about it. So how did it go from the screenplay and the TV Bible and the pilot to getting an agent and the book deal? Did that happen fairly quickly?
Yeah, so I already had an agent. I had an acting agent at the time who also had some kind of connections with theater, and so she had some playwrights on her books, and she had some screenwriters on her books. So I was actually represented as a screenwriter. When she got, because she was getting all this feedback and giving it back to me, so I wrote the book in October, between October and December of 2020, yeah, 2020, in lockdown, during the second lockdown, and then took it to her. And it was very much right place, right time. She kind of, I think it's okay to say this, but she sorry, Lou, if it's not, she had one contact in the publishing industry. I'm sure she might have had more, but like there was really just the one person, which was Katie Ellis Brown. And we went to her with this book, and just said, could just read this and just give us some feedback. Like, we weren't, it's funny because I know now about, what do they call it, edit and resubmit, where the, or resubmit and something, where you can send it into a publisher and they'll say, if you change this and this and this, we'll take it on, or we'll think about taking it on. Or like, we didn't have any concept of that. This was very much like, this was a friend of hers from uni, and could you please like just tell us if there's something in this. And she was very, very kind, and read the book in January, and sort of gave, she's like, this is where I think it's strong, this is where I think it's weak. But it was very encouraging at the time, and kind of definitely, there was kind of never a question that I was gonna edit it. Like, there was never a question that I think she really thought that there was something there. So I sent, so I did in that, so I did another batch of edits, which I did over about 4 or 5 weeks. And then the story of actually how it got picked up, Katie was doing maternity cover at Bloomsbury, at Raven, at the imprint, and we sent it to her. And I remember this is like kind of one of those fun stories in publishing that you hear about, I think. But we sent it on a bank holiday weekend, on like the Thursday before bank holiday, and she said, I think it was the end of April, beginning of May, and she said, I'm really busy this month, but I'll get to this by the end of the month. I'll be like, yeah, of course, take your time. And I sent it on Thursday, and I'm pretty sure I heard back Tuesday, and she had read it, and she was pitching it to her team. You know, it was like kind of real fairy tale level stuff where she's pitching it to her team the next day, and I needed to send a one page bio and like two more book ideas, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I have two more book ideas. And so then, you know, then we pitched it, and 3 weeks later, we got the contract through. We got the book deal at the end
Amazing.
of May. So it happened. Yeah, it happened really, really fast.
I think it's that funny thing about publishing, and it's frustrating, I guess, to hear, but there are so many little parts that you're like, well, this person had to be in this exact position it all work out well, and it's, you know, there's elements of luck and opportunity, and yeah, it's frustrating probably if people are struggling to get a book deal, but sometimes it is a case of right place, right time, and you can't plan for that. You just have to hope that you're, I mean, if you've got a strong idea like yours was, it makes someone read over the bank holiday. It makes someone skip ahead or think, oh, I'm going to put this to the top of my pile. And really, I think it is that great idea or that really, you know, amazing hook, or they can already kind of envision the campaign that they're going to make for your book. And obviously, your book was so appealing in that sense. And we're at a point where kind of feminist retellings are so hot, and everyone wants the kind of to see these stories that we know from a different perspective. So I think that kind of obviously played really well in your favor.
What's also quite exciting at the minute is I love Greek retellings. I grew up on the Greek myths. I had a very weird and wonderful childhood. That I was learning about, you know, Odysseus and Theseus when I was about 8 years old. And I love that, but we're starting to move away from that, and we're starting, you know, we've got kind of retellings, you know, a lot of Shakespeare retellings. We've got some other, and we're kind of moving away from that. And I often see Lady Macbeth, kind of, if they're in a list of like retellings to watch or something like that, it'll be kind of one of the only ones that is not a Greek retelling. And that's I'm not saying any kind of like, I'm not making any judgment on that either for me or for other people, but what I am saying is that I do think I was very lucky in that sense, in that I feel like I kind of got in at the beginning of a trend, which is one of those things that you can't plan for. And I think in my limited advice to other people, and I think there's a lot of crossover in terms of with the acting industry, is you have to be authentic, like, to the stories you want to tell, and you have to be authentic to who you are, like, you know, to relate it to acting. You can't go into an audition thinking, oh, well, they want this kind of person, because first of all, they might not, and second of all, even if they do, then that's not who you are. It will come across, and then that casting director will think of you as someone who you're not. So you really have to just be authentic, trust yourself, and trust that the right door will open, and when it does for you, it will be your door. And similarly, I can only imagine that this is also true with writing, is you just have to write those stories that you are drawn to and that you love, and you kind of have to not think about the industry, you know, which I know is easier said than done, because everybody wants their stories. And I have all sorts of obscure ideas that I'd really like to write, and I'm like, oh, I really don't know if anyone's gonna buy that. But yeah, you know, it is kind of the stars aligned, and I was very fortunate, and I'm very, very thankful to have found myself in that position, especially, yeah, with a character like Lady Macbeth. You know, a lot, so much of the work is done for me, because I don't have to tell you like who she is. Most people at least have some idea of the character.
So as we're speaking about the industry, I was wondering, in your kind of journey to publication, since you signed your book deal and now you're published, has there anything that's happened or that you've learned along the way that you found particularly surprising or challenging, that things that you've had to deal with maybe that you weren't expecting? I know you are kind of brand new to publishing. It was all a mystery, but has there been anything that you've learned along the way?
Yes, I've learned masses, and I think it's really funny, because I was talking to Hannah, who wrote God Killer. She's a friend of mine. I saw her. I went up to Scotland for my book tour, and we went and met up and had dinner. And we were talking about how they need to have, I don't know if I can swear on this podcast,
Yeah, you can
but
swear, it's fine.
okay, amazing. They need to have like shit writers bingo cards where it's like, or like shit experience, your shit first experiences, because I think you so often just get the fairy tale and the everything. So, on this bingo card, we have a square for like your first 1-star review, and we have a square for like a review, a bad review published in a newspaper on the day of publication, which may or may not have happened to me. And then you have like, a square for you do an event that nobody shows up to, and which has happened and happens all the time. I think I really dread that day if and when it comes, because that is, it's never easy. But like there are so many experiences like that, and yeah, Hannah and I had good fun trying to think about all the things that we would put on like this bingo card to kind of welcome new writers into the industry. And so I had, I didn't, I had no idea what to expect, and there were a lot of things like that. And I think for me, I feel kind of lucky in the sense that there were a lot of things that I didn't have expectations of, because I hadn't even been in the industry long enough to Google it. Like I'd never even Googled like how much to expect for an advance, or do you sign a 1-book deal or a 2-book deal? Like I didn't know any of that stuff. And then the few things when I did start to meet other writers, and they were like, oh, this is probably how much you'll it'll how much you'll get if you sell if and when you sell to the States. And then when I sold to the States, it was nothing close to that. And I was like, even the few expectations that I then did have was all it always massively underwent. So I was like, okay, I'm just not gonna have any expectations. So there was definitely, I think that was kind of a real, yeah, a real blessing to not to really not have any preconceived ideas. I didn't even have any writer friends. Like I didn't even know anybody who has been published, even self-published, not even self-published, but you know what I mean? Like I know nobody who is published in any way. And that was hard at first because it was like, oh, what does this mean? But I think definitely in the early days, it really helped me have those blinders on. So I was able to just enjoy the process, and I wasn't thinking about that. The one experience that I kind of did want to talk about, actually, just because I'm sure it's not unique and it really threw me, was the lovely Katie Ellis Brown, who was just the biggest cheerleader and champion. She was the commissioning editor. She brought, my book into Raven and was a massive champion, very enthusiastic as a person. Like, I just absolutely adore her. She listens to this. She was just doing maternity cover. So about kind of very solidly into the edit, we were kind of nearing maybe, we only had one edit left, one or two. We'd done about three or four with her, and I'd really worked with her to change the, to make the story better, and like tons, I cut loads of stuff and added loads of stuff. And then she left. And so then, my kind of my one point of contact at Bloomsbury was gone, and it was Allison, who I, now I know her now, and I love her, and I love working with her, and working on book two with her is just such a dream. But at the time, as a first time novelist, it was really destabilizing, because I was like, does this are they going to drop the book? Like, was because I didn't know that like there was an entire budget for this, like they're not going to drop the book, but from my perspective, there's so much that we don't see, and there's so much that we don't know about. And in my head, I was like, oh, I just had this one person who was really championing this book, and I hadn't quite understood the scope of it yet, and the fact that, yeah, there were people in Australia who were already working on, like, at the time, marketing and stuff like that. And it took me a while to kind of, I think because everything did happen so fast, and it was kind of such a fairy tale type thing, I sort of just expected it to go away at any moment. And I think that is, even in speaking to someone like Hannah, who has a very opposite experience to me, she's been in the industry for about 10 years. I don't know if people know that or are familiar with that, but she's written like 6 books before God Killer, and God Killer is her debut. I think more than that. I think she's written like 10. She is so prolific. It's incredible. But even for someone like her, like there's, completely opposite experience, but still that sense of like this could all fall apart at any moment. And I think when that switch happened, there was this real sense of even, and it's, I feel so embarrassed even now to say it, because Allison was also the biggest champion, and she totally got the book and like was so reassuring and was just has been absolutely incredible. But there was definitely a time where I was like, what if she doesn't like it, or what if she doesn't get it, or what if, you know, what if j just because you only have this one point of contact at a publishing thing, and then when that goes, it can be re really destabilizing. And I think that's why, you know, it is really, really important to have that relationship with your agent. Because I definitely wait, but I have the most patient agent in the world, where I was just calling her and I was like, they're just gonna hate me, like everyone's gonna drop it. She's like, oh my gosh, woman. No, she's very kind. But you know, so there were a lot of like little things, but there were also, you know, there were a couple of like big things that happened that were kind of like I found that far more destabilizing than kind of getting bad reviews. That wasn't, you know, that wasn't really anything, you know, compared to that. Actually, I will say on the subject of reviews, because you brought this up earlier, it's like I do find, because I think I've stopped reading reviews now, just because I'm, you know, I'm kind of now my head is fully in the second book. But I was reading, you know, I do read a lot of the reviews, and I find it so funny when people say the opposite thing, you know, where it's like, oh, this book is definite, like this terribly researched, you know, like absolutely has no idea what she's talking about. And then someone's like, this book is so well researched. And it's just like, it makes me really laugh. Or like, oh, go
I
ahead.
had one review that was like, this is the most perfect ending to a book. And then I had another review that was like, this ending was terrible.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I actually, it's funny because I get a sort of perverse, I don't know if joy is necessarily the right word, but out of, I think you have to, like every writer is going to have to deal with bad reviews in their own way. Either they're not going to just read reviews full stop, or they're going to laugh them off, or, you know, or they're going to use them for fodder for future books as revenge. but yeah, I found I think the contradictory nature of reviews really helps. I bring them into perspective, I think, especially, yeah, with mine, the two things are the research, like either someone thinks it's really badly researched or really well researched, and then also just the character, like some people really love her, and I've had some reviews who just hate her, like it's like I've written, you know, a treatise on Nazism or something, you know, like the loathing that they have for this character. And I find that, just from like a human study perspective, so fascinating that you can have people, you know, because we're all just people, and it's all taste and preference really at the end of the day. And that, you know, I wouldn't say that is, you know, you talk about challenges, I guess, in this industry. I wouldn't necessarily say it was a challenge, but it's something to, it's just something to be aware of, and something that I find really fascinating of, like when you do have, you could have 30 good reviews and one bad review. And for me, it doesn't like tip the balances or anything, but that one review definitely gets more weight in my mind. And I do always weigh it against other ones. And there's sometimes, oh, that was it. Actually, I think this is a fun thing as well. And again, I'm not calling this person out in any way. But the very first review that I got, I think actually maybe this is probably helpful for other writers listening. First of all, the very, very first review I got on NetGalley was 1 star. And I've kind of referenced this earlier, which again, absolutely fine, like no hard feelings. But I got a really horrible review that was published on, like, obviously just somebody really didn't like my book, which is fine. But it was published on the day of, like, it came out the day that my book was published, and I was tagged in it on Twitter by name. And so yeah, so these things do happen, and it's fine. But with the 1 star review, they compared me to Philippa Gregory, and I was, because they were like, oh, this is just like all that Philippa Gregory stuff. And I was like, that's actually, like, I know that you meant that as an insult, but I'm actually massively complimented by that. So I think there's always stuff like that that you just kind of have to learn how to, you really do have to learn to take in stride. And I think, sorry, I know I've been saying a lot about this, but I do think it's important. And I think as well, actually being an actor, I have a particularly unique take on having a thick skin, because people say things to actors that you wouldn't say to your worst enemy. People could be really horrific and vicious, and it's getting so much better. But especially, like, I'm in LA at the minute, and you hear stories about people saying, "Well, you're just too fat for this role," like to their face, like and kind of really, or you have no personality. Like, sorry, honey. Like, we love you, but you just have no personality, and you're just gonna have to you have to develop such a thick skin. And so, I think similarly as in writing, you just learning to take that in stride is definitely something to, I think, a valuable skill to learn very, very early on, because it's gonna happen.
So finally, as well, please tell us a little hint about what you're working on next.
Yes. So I what can I tell you? I haven't got this down to the elevator pitch yet, because we're only in the second draft. But what I can say is that it's another historical fiction. It is not a retelling. However, it borrows elements from a particular fairy tale that I love. It is set in the mid 1600s in Bern in Switzerland. And it is told from two different perspectives, from a young man and a young woman set about 15 years apart. And it's about, kind of, primarily it's about a young woman who finds out that her father is a serial killer. And it looks at kind of the question of, what do you do when you're confronted by evil? Do you run away from it? Do you confront it? Do you take matters into your own hands? Is there is there any such thing as vigilante justice? Like, there's all these, it kind of explores these big questions. But more than that, for me, it's a really special story, because my father is from Switzerland. He grew up in this little alpine village, in kind of right in the middle of Switzerland. And so it's been such a gift to be able to research the history of this country, and kind of, we're not from Bern, but to really, unpack the whole history of this particular city, which in the mid 1600s is, again, kind of a time of political upheaval. It's about 100 years after the Reformation. There are still scars all over the city of, from the Reformation, and from that schism. There's a big peasant revolt that happens around this time. And so it's kind of bubbling with, like, the setting itself is already bubbling with quite a lot of tension and quite a lot of turmoil. And so to kind of put this story and to set the story at this time, I think, is a real, I'm absolutely loving writing it. And it's just, it's quite thrilling to me to be able to explore this story in this setting.
Well, it sounds very exciting as well, and thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Isabel Schuler talking about her historical novel, Lady Macbethad, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors, and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.